Welcome to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with Thomas Jefferson, our third president. Mr. Jefferson is portrayed by the award-winning humanities scholar and author, Clay Jenkinson. I'm your host, David Swenson, and seated across from me now is President Thomas Jefferson. Good day to you, sir.
Good day to you, citizen.
And Mr. Jefferson, how are things in Virginia today?
Oh, you know, the autumn in Virginia is a splendid time. The trees lose their leaves, but there's a kind of a wonderful, sensuous quality to life in Virginia. The red earth stands out more completely, and it's a time of fixing farm equipment and preparing for the next year's crops, but it's a relieving time for the slave populations. They have less to do. It's really a kind of a period of abundance and almost hibernation. And I like all the seasons at Monticello, but I do like that sense of the cornucopia of the fall harvest and the relaxation that can follow it.
Oh, I would agree with you, sir. I do love the fall myself. And speaking of the outdoors, I have some questions for you this week, and one of them is of an agrarian nature, which I know is a subject you enjoy very much. But Sam Guyden writes, Mr. Jefferson, were you a follower of Jethro Tull? With unpaid servants doing much of your farm work, how much time did you spend in farming with your own hands?
Well, that's a great question. Jethro Tull was a British agrarian reformist who lived a little earlier than I did. In fact, he died in 1741, which was just 2 years before my birth in Virginia. But he was a very extraordinary man.
Inventive.
He invented the seed drill. You know, up till that time, the seeds for wheat or corn were broadcast. They were scattered over the land.
Very inefficient.
And they would either take root or not. And he developed a primitive seed drill that actually created a small hole, a well, into which the seed was deposited and then covered up with earth. This revolutionized agriculture. He also was an advocate of the horse rather than the ox as a draft animal for plowing. And he had a theory of deep tilling, which was entirely new in the history of European agriculture. So he's an innovator, someone who's constantly thinking of how to improve agriculture, and also a practical inventor. And I was aware of his work. You know, I obviously never met him, but I was aware of his work and read books by and about Jethro Tull and tried to incorporate at Monticello and my other farms as much scientific agriculture as possible. For example, I had a 7-year crop rotation system, which was virtually unique in Virginia, trying to repair the fields with amelioratives after the draining crops like corn and tobacco. My son-in-law, Thomas Mann Randolph, was an erratic fellow, but he was an extraordinary farmer, and he introduced contour plowing to Virginia. You know, most plowing was up and down. We get these tremendous rainstorms, and they would wash away the soils, erode the hillsides of Virginia, which had been stripped of their trees. My son-in-law, he was satirized by his neighbors for this, but he created contour plowing to keep the water from washing away the soil during
these
rains. And it worked. It's also beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
We had shelter belts. I invented a hemp drill, a seed sowing system for hemp. We were constantly trying to take the spirit of Jethro Tull and others like him, Arthur Young among them, and to incorporate this into every aspect of our agricultural lives to get a little more yield, to reduce the labor of plowing, to take some of the time consumption away from these tasks, to keep the soils healthy over the long term, to show real stewardship rather than a more extractive approach to agriculture. And so I honor the spirit of the great Jethro Tull.
And were his, I mean, he lived in northern England, is that correct?
Berkshire, I believe.
I'm curious to know in your time, you know, obviously this man had made some breakthroughs in a technological sense to allow farmers to become more efficient. And I know that was the spirit of your inventive work as well. Did it take a long time for people to accept these new methods, or were they readily accepted? And did they come to America as just part of the craft of farming, or was it something that you had to study and learn?
No, it is something you study and learn. You know, this is really a question much broader than agriculture. If you think about the nature of civilization, if you look around at the way you move, the way you feed yourself, the way you shelter yourself, how you sleep, the clothes that you wear, the conversations you engage in, the subjects that interest you, the way you worship, the way you buy and sell things in the public square, there's a high level of artifice to all of this. There's nothing necessarily natural about the way we worship or the buildings that we create. You know, a cathedral is an unnatural building. It's not designed to fit into the contours of a village in France. It's designed to aggrandize God and our relationship with God. An economy may be completely irrational at its core. It may. In France, I tried to reform our economic relationship with France so that they would buy whale oil and linseed oil and indigo and American tobacco. And the French ministers of finance would always say, you know, Mr. Jefferson, of course you're right, that free trade would be better. It would be better for everybody if we could lower the tariffs and if we would take some of the bureaucratic restraints out of the trade between the United States and France. But then they would say, but it's always been done this way. And if we tried to reform this, it would offend certain elements of our aristocracy and even our court circles around Louis XVI. So we don't dare do what we know makes good sense because the system is too deeply rooted in its irrationality. This is true of religion, it's true of economics, it's true of agriculture, it's true of education. We do things not because they're the best way to do them, we do them because they've always been done that way, or it's more difficult to contemplate reform than it is simply to shrug your shoulders and live with a highly imperfect system. If you think about your life and the reforms that you think need to be made in all the walks, in all the range of life in the early 21st century, ask yourself why those reforms don't come, and it's always the same answer. Well, there are entrenched interests. It would be disruptive. How would you train professionals to do it in a different way? Whose ox is gored? And so this is a perennial refrain in human civilization. And what the Enlightenment was about was cataloging everything. You know, how do you classify plants? How do you classify clouds? How do you classify chemical elements? How do you classify the animals in the field? How do you classify human beings and language groups? You know, so the Enlightenment was about taxonomy and classification, and it was all really stemming from the work of Francis Bacon in the Elizabethan age. The notion was if you can classify everything and put everything in the right category, the right box, label it correctly, then you can step back and say, all right, now how can we make it better? You know, you start by describing the world faithfully, and then you say, could we plow better? Well, I was in Europe and I saw a peasant plowing with an inefficient plow and I designed a better plow. And I don't take any credit for this, but mathematics was able to reform the shape of a plowshare. Jethro Tull looked out and saw, you know, seeds that had been broadcast over the ground not taking root, not germinating. And he thought, this is a waste. How can we improve this so that if you plant seeds, you get a higher germination rate? And so then he went to work on it and figured, we'll dig a little hole. How do you do that fast? Because it's one thing in a garden to plant a peas in a little hole and then cover it and then dig another little hole and plant more beans or peas or lettuce. But how do you do that over 10 acres without having, you know, hundreds of stoop laborers? So he devises the first drill. And Eli Whitney of Connecticut is looking at the cotton bowl. The cotton bowl is like a marshmallow in your time. You know, it's very fluffy, and it's filled with these horrible little seeds, and the seeds prevent it from being used to make cloth. And there are hundreds of them. So how do you get these seeds out of the cotton bowl? Well, you could take a tweezers, and you do that, and it would take – enormous amounts of labor. So Eli Whitney thought, isn't there some kind of simple device that could be used to take the seeds out of the cotton? And he played around with it. And eventually he developed this gin, this engine, this machine. And it, with at a very low cost and a high efficiency and a high volume, could take the seeds out of the cotton bowl. And he thus revolutionized the cloth industry. This is the nature of the Enlightenment. You look at something, no matter what it is, the education of your children, the way you worship God, the way you transport yourself, the way you heat your house, whatever it turns out to be, you look at it and you think, is this the best system or is it wrongheaded in some ways? Could it be improved upon? Is there a way of innovating it? Could we make it better? Could we make it more efficient, make it cheaper? Could we make it more convenient? Could we make it more fun? And that's what humans do at their best, is they look at things and they innovate to create delight, leisure, longevity, efficiency. Take medicine. In my time, when someone was sick, we bled them or purged them. This was the best medicine of our time. Dr. Benjamin Rush, my close friend, a signer of the Declaration of Independence, was a bleeder and a purger. Well, we know that these aren't good methods of medicine, so you keep looking at it, and suddenly surgery occurs. You know, surgery almost didn't exist in my time. Bone setting was primitive. I broke my right wrist in France. My hand never worked well again. Medicine has made enormous strides. We didn't have antibiotics. We didn't have organ transplants. We didn't have transfusions. All this has happened since my time. It's extraordinary, but you need to take the same spirit of innovation that you see in industry and in medicine and use it in education and use it in religion and use it in agriculture and use it in family relationships and in government.
Well, Mr. President, we need to pause for just a moment, but when we return, I'd like to continue this conversation, perhaps talk about how this inventive nature allowed more people to participate in the Enlightenment, and also we have a question about a second Enlightenment. We'll return in just a moment. You're listening to the Thomas Jefferson Hour. Welcome back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with Thomas Jefferson, our third president. And Mr. President, we've been talking about the work of Jethro Tull and others who made the work of the day more efficient. I know in previous conversations you've explained to me that this nature of improving everyday craft and work allowed the average citizen more time to perhaps read books or participate in conversation and thereby to further the Enlightenment. And when that initial question that we received about Jethro Tull, I look at a man like him as a great contributor because of that. Would that be a fair judgment in your view?
Indeed, yes. And these are the heroes of mankind. You know, my heroes were not Julius Caesar and Attila and Napoleon or Louis XIV. My heroes were Francis Bacon, John Locke, and Isaac Newton. These men who, through creative intelligence, have made life better on Earth or helped us to understand what appeared before that to be the mysteries of the universe. In 1800, when I was standing for the presidency, I stepped back to think about it, and I didn't really want to stand for the presidency. Mr. Madison was pushing me forward. I did want the Federalist to be retired. but I didn't think myself fitted to be president, and I frankly would have preferred to stay at Monticello, engaged in the joys and comforts of private life. But I decided that I would stand for the presidency in 1800, and in order to do a kind of self-catechizing, I made a list of my contributions to American life. And the question I asked myself is the world better for my having lived? If I'd never been born, how would the world be different from the way that it is? And you know what I put at the top of the list? That I had cleared the Ravana River of obstruction so that we could float our grain to market more readily than we had previously. You know, the roads were water. So we transported goods and services by boat. And the Ravana is a choked up little tributary of the James River. And I took up a subscription in Albemarle County to get funds together so we could clear it of its obstructions. And I went on a canoe trip myself down the river to determine where those obstructions were. And then we got it done. I regarded that as a contribution to American life. And I said the greatest service a man can do for his country is to introduce a new plant species into its midst. You know, this is what I call the amelioration of the condition of mankind. When I was in Europe, I made a tour of the wine districts of France, and I dropped down into Elysium, into Italy. I wanted to get all the way to Rome, but I just couldn't justify it, given my diplomatic work for the United States. I desperately wanted to see the ruins of Roman antiquity, but I just couldn't justify taking a vacation of that sort when I was effectively the American ambassador to France. But I did get into northern Italy just a little, and there I found some upland rice. Now, most rice is swamp rice. It's very unhealthful to grow. You know, people squatting in rice paddies. The Italians had an upland strain of rice, so dryland rice, just as good. And so I went there to inspect it. And when I saw that it worked, I thought this could be grown in South Carolina. We should have this rice. This would really, rice is a great staple crop. You know, rice and wheat are the world's two most important grains. And I thought, I'm going to introduce rice to the United States. But then I learned that it was a capital crime to export unprocessed Italian rice. They were trying to protect their industry by making it a crime to take this rice out of the country. Well, you know what I thought? I thought this is a foolish law, because why should, for local profit, the people of this district of Italy prevent the spread of one of the world's most extraordinary grains that could feed the poor in other countries? That's outrageous. And so I hired a muleteer, a porter, to put a couple of bushels of that rice in his saddlebags and smuggle it across the Italian border into France. And if he'd been caught,
goodness, Mr. Jefferson,
he would have been punished. And then just to make sure, in case he were arrested, I took a few hands full of that rice and put them in my pockets and walked out of Italy into France. And I brought that upland rice back to the United States, and I distributed it. I gave it to agricultural organizations in the Carolinas and said, try it. And I hoped that that rice would revolutionize American agriculture. And it did gain considerable use in the Carolinas, particularly South Carolina, during the course of my life. But that's my idea of the Enlightenment. You spread ideas.
Breaking laws?
I don't mind breaking that law, because that's a ridiculous law.
Mm-hmm. Justified dissent?
Well, if let's say that you developed a cure for cancer, and then you trademarked it and monopolized that information, and you would sell it to somebody who is dying of pancreatic cancer for $1 million. That's an outrage. If you develop a cure for cancer, you're entitled to reasonable profits as an incentive to invention and as a reward for your discovery. But you are not entitled to prevent the dissemination of something so important to the happiness of humankind. When a law does that, when it prevents the spread of the good news of science, that law is illiberal and is effectively, from an Enlightenment point of view, null and void.
Well, please, Mr. President, understand that I sympathize with your views and agree with them completely.
I brought that rice back to the United States. The muleteer was not arrested at the border. I got all the rice out. That's, in my opinion, a gift to American life that is at least as important as the Declaration of Independence.
And a very interesting story, which I was not aware of. I thank you for sharing it.
It's a great story. It's a little compromising from a diplomatic point of view. It would have been quite embarrassing if I had been stopped at the border and found with my pockets stuffed with rice, but it didn't occur.
Diplomats might have been frequent. A more interesting story in some ways had that happened.
I'm sure I would have talked my way through it using Baconian principles.
Well, moving on with this thought of the Enlightenment in Europe, we have a question sent to us from an Edward Blanchard. He writes, "The American dream was born of Enlightenment ideas which informed the Founding Fathers' thinking. Today's global orientation is thought by some to have spawned the Second Enlightenment." He talks about the European Union. He says it's a loose confederation of sovereign states which proclaim the goals of quality of life, sustainability, universal human rights, the rights of nature, and peace. And he asks, would you see the communal attitude of modern Europe as a logical extension of the philosophy of your age, or does it stand in opposition to the propositions put forward by the American Revolution?
No, I think he's absolutely right that in your time, what's happening in Europe, the creation of a common currency, the creation of a common and uniform code of laws, the dropping of certain types of sovereignty and the creation of a universal passport or open borders for European citizens, the dropping of tariffs and economic protectionism in European countries. All of that is extraordinarily good. You know, human nature is everywhere the same. Languages are different. Customs are different. Institutions are different. But human nature is a constant. And the more we tear down these artificial barriers and create a kind of citizenship of the world, the better off we are. And, of course, nations who are part of a union don't go to war with each other. If France and Germany are part of a European Union and they come to some sort of fundamental dispute, they're likely to settle that by arbitration. But without a union of this sort, when two nations come to a fundamental dispute, if there's no higher arbiter, then the only recourse is to war. You know, in other words, if Maryland and Delaware get into a border dispute, if there were no United States government over those two constituent states, they might go to war. But if there's a United States government and Maryland and Delaware are engaged in a border dispute, that dispute is submitted to the Supreme Court of the United States, and that court provides final arbitration. And it may be that Delaware feels cheated or Maryland doesn't think that it got all that it intended, but they have both agreed under social compact to abide by the decision of that court without bloodshed. And so this is an extraordinary breakthrough when you can create, in your time, 50 sovereign American nation states, Alaska, Texas, Florida, Maine, and they have voluntarily agreed to submit any fundamental disputes to the nation and to abide by the decision of the nation, even if that decision offends them to the core. That's remarkable. And if it can be done for the United States, if it can be done for Canada, two of the largest land masses on Earth, then why couldn't it be done for Europe and Asia and the Middle East? And why couldn't Europe and the United States agree to an overarching sovereign of some sort that would solve a dispute between Denmark and the United States or between Canada and Syria? There should be a way to end war once and for all using the model that we created of a dual sovereign. The United States is sovereign fundamentally here, but in many respects, Virginia and North Carolina are sovereign too as states. There's a dual sovereignty. if either one of them becomes too powerful, it breaks down. But if there's a fine balance between national sovereignty and state and local sovereignties, the system works. And the same system, I believe, can thrive in Europe. And if it can thrive there, it probably can thrive all over the earth.
Well, let me reread the second half of his question once more. He writes, "The American dream from the first Enlightenment comprises material progress, pursuit of self-interest, and individual autonomy." And again, would you see the communal attitude of modern Europe as a logical extension of the philosophy of your age, or does it stand in opposition to the propositions put forward by the American Revolution?
Well, our system, he rightly notes, is a highly individualistic system in which we've subordinated our collective will to a certain degree to individual pursuits of happiness. It's a Lockean notion that the nature of civilization is really self-interested individuals who come together reluctantly to do extremely few public things. That is a strain in the American character that derives from the work of John Locke and people like him. And when Alexis de Tocqueville came here in the 1830s, just after my time, he noticed this and said that the individual in America is king, so much so that he coined the word individualism, that America's characterized by not collectivism or nationalism or patriotism. It's characterized, said Tocqueville, by individualism. That's how profound it was to a European observer from France and to a much more tightly knitted social fabric coming to see this very loose and autonomous system that we have in the United States, partly made possible by the immense space, the immense land base of the New World. So, I see that.
But it comes, you're saying, from the work of Locke. I mean, it must have come prior to that, that the individual as an important.
Well, the idea of self-interest has a long
pedigree.
We're
not tribal now, we're individual.
That's a modern breakthrough, and you see it in the Declaration of Independence. All men are created equal.
Right. I mean,
that's not how tribal systems operate. If you look at the Sioux or the Afghanis or the Kurds or the Cheyenne or the Seminoles, they have a tribal system in which the individual is subordinated to tribal ways and means. That's not the American style. The American style is that I'm the king of my domain at Monticello, and I'm separate in fundamental ways from Mr. Madison and James Monroe and everybody else.
The democracy can't really exist without that individual thought process, can it?
I'm not certain of that. I think that there can be more communal democracies. And towards the end of my life, I became more interested in collective things. I think the Lockean impulse of leave me alone, don't tread on me, get government off my back, liberate all aspects of the individual, I think that can be taken too far and it becomes antisocial.
It seems to me that American society needs individuals to stand up and say those things. Otherwise, we become, what did you refer to it as, the mobocracy?
That was not my sort of term, but it was used during the Constitution.
As follow me, things have fallen, follow me.
We don't like the leader on the white horse.
Right.
We don't like that notion of the mob submitting to the demagoguery of the strong man or the rich man or the aristocrat. That's a European habit that's not in the American character. But my point is, I think a balance can be struck between individualism and the community, and that needs to be very carefully struck. I don't think that there's any fundamental contradiction here. I think that in the European Union, what you're creating is a matrix in which individuals can pursue happiness. In other words, I don't think you cease being Norwegian by belonging to the European Union. I think it just makes border crossing, economic exchange, services, and the European rights tradition stronger without denying the individual his sovereignty in his own person. I think you are living through the last years of the world's second Enlightenment. The first Enlightenment came between, say, 1650 and 1820. And that Enlightenment did more for human happiness, I think, than any other period in human history. It was characterized by reason, progress, materialism, economic expansion, and a commitment to human rights, constitution making. That Enlightenment is the Enlightenment to which Dr. Franklin belonged and to which I belonged, and I'm immensely proud of it. And I think that it should have gone farther, frankly. Then there was the Romantic reaction to the Age of Reason, characterized in the United States by people like Henry David Thoreau and Edgar Allan Poe and Herman Melville, a kind of deliberate reaction against what was seen as the prosaic rationality of the Enlightenment. I'm not very fond of that. I don't trust the heart very much. And then in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, in your era, there was a second American Enlightenment in which the rights tradition was radically expanded to include black people and American Indians and Hispanic people and women and other minorities. And the wall of separation was built higher than it had ever been built in American history so far. And education, including college education, was spread more widely across the American spectrum than at any previous time. And science, characterized by, say, your space program, was triumphant. And that Enlightenment, I believe, is now in danger. That second American Enlightenment has been reacted to by fundamentalisms at home and abroad, and by a kind of a scared castle siege mentality, which is dividing nations back into separate sovereignties and tribal entities, and that is a dangerous trend that needs to be overcome by a new era of Baconian and Lockean Enlightenment.
Well, thank you, Mr. Jefferson. You leave me with both optimism and concern, and also a great conversation. We need to take a short pause. But when we return, we'll be talking with the man who portrays Thomas Jefferson, the award-winning humanities scholar and author Clay Jenkinson. You're listening to The Thomas Jefferson Hour. Welcome back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with Thomas Jefferson, our third president, and your weekly conversation with Clay Jenkinson, the award-winning humanities scholar and author, and my friend, and it's good to see you, Clay.
David Swenson, my dear friend, here at the second floor of the New Enlightenment Radio Network barn in Dakota. It's always great to see you. You know, this is a conversation we've never had before,
And we need to thank our many listeners and those who wrote the questions. They lead us there.
It sort of put me into a funk. I don't know about you, but here's how I see it, and you tell me how you see it. And you can get a phone now on which you can write and edit Word documents, and you can get website downloads in the middle of the desert or in Antarctica, and you can communicate anywhere on Earth. And we have these devices, and the haves have these devices, and they're magnificent. I'm addicted to every one of them. You know, and systems are so much better than they were. If you think of something like FedEx or Amazon.com or UPS, you know, when I was growing up, long distance only occurred when there was a death in the family or at holidays. And now, you know, long-distance telephone is too cheap to meter. The first website was 1991, you know, 15 years ago, the first website. Now there are literally millions of websites, and some of them are unbelievably powerful and useful. 1% pornographic, I just read. 1% of all websites, pornography. But 99% better. We live in this extraordinary time, David, and I love it. But at the same time, I don't know if you have this experience, as I sort of walk around, I go to an airport and there are men who don't wash their hands after using toilets. And there's rudeness and incivility, and there's fundamentalism. You know, radical, violent, rock-throwing, bomb-throwing fundamentalism here and abroad. And so you see on the one hand the Second Enlightenment ameliorating the condition of mankind in just ways that are immeasurably amazing. And then on the other hand, you see this medieval anti-hygienic obscurantism, darkness, obsession with sin and power and violence, sexual predation. You try to figure out, what is this, that these two things can coexist? You know, back in Jefferson's time,
it was just the same.
But it was low tech. And now we have this high tech.
I was going to try to reach out and grab you and bring you back.
Okay, tell me. It was just the same. How?
You tell me. What's more important, being able to download a text message in Antarctica or having a piece of equipment invented by Jethro Tull that made crops grow better? And what's more barbaric, the Barbary pirates in that war, or what's going on in an airport today? I mean, it just grows and changes, but it's the same story.
It's the same human story, but what Jefferson thought, and here's the failed promise of the Enlightenment. This is a really serious issue. What Jefferson thought was that the Enlightenment was going to spread like food coloring in a big glass of water. That, you know, there'd be this intense burst of red right where it hits.
No, he didn't.
Yes, he did.
No,
that
he
the Enlightenment
didn't.
Was going to spread, and it was going to cover everybody.
He was way too intelligent
to actually
believe that.
He wasn't, because if you're right, then he never spoke the truth, because everything he ever wrote or did or said—
Well, I think that would be a little bit harsh.
Everything he wrote and did and said in the whole course of his life was for this diffusion theory.
I think life was a big dinner party to him. it was as he's talked about, he would be in the White House and he would have everything just correct and the wine would come out and then he would nudge Mr. Madison and Mr. Madison. I think he looked at leadership that way too.
I think he believed.
I don't think he may not have ever told the truth.
The
I
life
don't know
was
if
going,
I'd be that rude.
He didn't
about
tell
it,
the truth about human nature. If what you're saying is true, and I think you're wrong. Uh-huh. I think Jefferson believed that we were going to improve everything for everybody until everybody became a little Jefferson. Everybody designed his own house, wrote a lot of letters, read a lot of books, treated other people with deep civility, mm-hmm. grew food, that there was going to, and was committed to science and good sense, and that the whole universe was going to learn how to wash its hands in an airport.
Well, maybe he was so smart that he knew that if he lived according to these rules and this persona, that he could improve humankind, and that's what he did.
Yes, but you're saying, but where we disagree is that you're saying he must have understood that there are always going to be people who don't get on board.
Right.
I don't think he understood that. I think he thought...
Please don't misunderstand me. I'm not trying to characterize Jefferson as some sort of a manipulative character. It's just, I was reading Brodie's book recently, and there's a section in there where in the mid-1780s, Jefferson wrote a series of letters to young men, including Monroe, that he worked with, and he was urging them all to buy land near Monticello. And I think it was, she put it, he wanted to be surrounded by a rational society within close distance. He was trying to create this rational world with excellent company. And in the same segment, she talks about a Dutchman whose name escapes me, who wrote him a letter. He had met Jefferson once, and like many, was drawn to him and wanted to see him again, and wrote him a letter complimenting him on his benevolent character, but pitying his situation because he thought he was unhappy. Jefferson wrote back, and his letter acknowledged this unhappiness, but the letter also said that he had hoped that no one would perceive this unhappiness. And then in the letter, he goes on to say that he has known losses of all types that humans suffer. So I guess what to me that was sort of a recognition that he did have this secret life that he lived, and he hoped that people would not see it. And that's why I come to this conclusion that that perhaps what he was doing at some times was living as an example to others. And to me, that may be a bit of a key to his character, but it's a question that I certainly
This is one of the
answer.
Hardest questions.
I'm sure. We'll never know.
We'll never know because, I mean, when I think of Jefferson in the face of the Holocaust, in the face of Islamic fundamentalism, in the face of America's actions in the world, in the face of the evangelical right in America, you know, people saying that if the people of a Pennsylvania town don't teach creationism in their schools, they might be smitten by tornadoes, by God's wrath. I mean, this nonsense, this utter nonsense, coupled with all the magnificent bloodshed of the 20th century, the bestiality of human culture, including Europe, makes Jefferson look like an idiot, like Pollyanna. I mean, how could he believe human happiness was going to prevail?
There he is, you know, and there's truths that never change. You're born, you live, you die. And I don't know that, you know, I don't know that the carnage of the Revolutionary War was any less than the carnage of a war that goes on today.
The carnal spirit was no different, but the carnage was different because we have devices that kill millions or tens of thousands rather than one.
Yeah, but for the individual, it's not a lot different. You're dead. You suffer and you're dead. And you're faced with, a life-changing event that you're faced with deciding that your life is more important than someone else's and you're going to kill them.
Don't you think, I mean, when you look at war, okay, so we're fighting one in Iraq and one in Afghanistan. There are wars being fought in Africa. There are wars being fought in Asia.
Mm-hmm.
There are warlords in South America, and there are gangs in Los Angeles and Houston. You know, war is ubiquitous. People solving their disputes by violence. People dealing mayhem, sometimes out of sheer joy of mayhem. When you look at that, David, from the outside, and you think, whoa, it's the 21st century, and I have a PDA which can tell me every financial transaction that I've engaged in for the last year. I have a computer which I paid $800 for, which is better than the best computer of 1960. I have a computer in my car, which is better than the computers on the Apollo space program. And then you think, and yet there's some guy who thinks he didn't get enough respect at the pub, and so he takes a 9mm gun and shoots five people. I have a hard time squaring the mayhem factor with the Enlightenment factor. It just seems glaringly out of sync.
I think they coexist, and I mean, there's just no way around that, you know.
That this is just the mix, the muddled mix of humanity.
Except, you know, Jefferson wanted more to do with one side than the other, and who wouldn't?
But I mean, just let me look at it this way, and I'm not trying to be perverse. I know you're sort of saying, "What kind of fool are you that you don't see life in front of you?"
Oh, not at all. This is the point of our discussion, and I love to, you know.
I'm a Jeffersonian, so I believe in all this amelioration stuff. Why couldn't we educate people into civility and good sense? Why is that such an unlikely prospect?
You will not get that argument from me, sir.
Why could we not create a much better civilization than
we
have?
I'm with you completely. I think that's absolutely the attitude of Jefferson, and that's the attitude we all should have.
It just seems to me that all enlightened people are tolerant. That there are certain protocols of human understanding that you come to through wisdom or education. And that if you actually worked hard at this to create a thoughtful, tolerant, civil society, you'd get one. Now, obviously, there are going to be things that can never be made to happen. But it seems to me that we accept an awful lot more mayhem than is required. And we even celebrate a fair portion of it. And that we really ought to be more, we ought to pitch our national and personal standards higher.
I'm with you. You got me. I vote for you.
Why not?
It comes back to that, you know, the discussion we had with Mr. Jefferson about the individual. And I think the key word that you used was tolerance. I think that is so important. But let me lift you out of this funk, if I might. We've gotten more mail about your appearance on the Stephen Colbert Report.
Oh, my goodness.
Good stuff.
Another career low.
No, you know, I could go through all these compliments about your new website and how wonderful it is.
Well, thanks in part to you, the website.
How much time people are spending on it. And,
wait till they see what we're going to do with the new website. I've got huge plans.
I had a very nice exchange of emails with an author whose name, I forget, it's not in front of me, but who was so anxious to get iPod downloads.
And that we now have that, do we not?
You go to iTunes and type in a search for the Thomas Jefferson Hour, and up they come. And so it's very
– The world is flat.
Easy. Right. Right.
I mean, Friedman is right. You can now podcast the Thomas Jefferson
Hour.
Well,
and it's great because, you know, a lot of people – we get a lot of email from folks who, for one reason or another, are unable to catch your show when it's broadcast.
Now anyone can hear it anywhere.
Somebody from Bakersfield couldn't get the show.
Somebody from Baghdad.
They can go to the site and they can download it on their computer, or they can go to iTunes and put it on an iPod or whatever. Or they can sit at their computer and listen to it.
Wouldn't it be cool if somebody in Baghdad who is a radical Muslim – terrorist or freedom fighter could hear the Jefferson Hour and say, you know what? This Jefferson's cool. We got to. Maybe we don't have to fight this. We can all get along. Shiite, Sunni, Kurd. We'll work this thing out.
I think you're shooting high there, but.
Well, why not?
Yeah.
Why not?
Anyway, the Colbert Report. To lift you back to that. Yeah. There was one letter from Clay Haskell, who said that because I am a regular listener of your radio show and I am proud of the fact that you appeared on the Colbert Show and won, all caps,
by
the best Jefferson competition, even if by a coin toss, he says. Mm. However, sir, I must say that to see you crowned, as it were, was most disconcerting. A truly Jeffersonian Jefferson would never, ever allow himself to be crowned for any reason. Putting a crown on Thomas Jefferson is just wrong, according to this guy.
Well, what are you going to do?
Do you want to leave that stand
this
or respond?
This was not part of – there was no briefing. So the three Jeffersons show up, Stephen of Philadelphia, Clay of Bismarck – they had it at Reno, they were wrong – and Bill Barker of Williamsburg. We show up. There's no briefing. We go through this. We don't know what's going to happen. And in the end, while the cameras are rolling, I get crowned as America's top Jefferson. Of course, Jefferson wouldn't allow himself to be crowned. Do you think he'd be on the Colbert Report? You know, do you think he'd be with other Jefferson
pretenders? The Comedy Central Network, right.
You have to kind of grant the chaos
of the thing. Well, I take this
as tongue-in-cheek.
Yes,
but
yes.
I was surprised to be crowned. And what they cut out, David, is that the runners-up got Rice-A-Roni. They got packages of Rice-A-Roni.
And poor you were left with nothing.
I got nothing. I said to Colbert, can I keep the crown and scepter? And he said, no, we have a low budget. So I didn't even get that. But I've gotten a lot of wonderful email from people about this. People that I've known and haven't had communications with for years have written, you know, the Colbert Report is a hot thing in America. Mm-hmm. So lots of people watch this.
And if anyone missed it, if you do go to jeffersonhour.org, there's a link so you can
hear
go watch it.
All over again.
Yeah,
my mother watched it. She's in a witness protection program now. my daughter watched it and she said, Daddy, you know, I thought better of you.
Oh, no.
Great.
Well, we also got a similar letter from a Brian Bartels or Bartels of Hays, Kansas, who wanted to know
places.
How you would have led a successful monarchy. I don't really think you need to answer that. But he enjoyed the performance very much and enjoys the
revolution. It was not as good a piece as the tape that remained on the cutting room floor, but I was crowned. People can go to the website. We have the clip can be played there. I have challenged Stephen Colbert for a return visit. Now that I've been crowned, I want a mano interview with Colbert.
So again this week, you repeat your challenge to Mr. Colbert. My advice, sir, would be to take your lumps and take the high road. And I'm afraid, sir, that will have to be the final word this week on the Thomas Jefferson Hour, as we are out of time. So I bid farewell to Mr. Jefferson and to you, my good friend, Clay Jenkinson.
My friend David Swenson.
We'll see you next week on the Thomas Jefferson Hour. You've been listening to the Thomas Jefferson Hour. Thomas Jefferson is portrayed by the award-winning humanities scholar and author Clay Jenkinson. Thomas Jefferson lived from 1743 to 1826, and this program presents his views. The title of this week's show is Jethro Tull. If you would like a copy of this or any past program for a $12 donation, please call 1-888-828-2853. Again, that number, 1-888-828-2853, or visit our website at www.jeffersonhour.org. The Thomas Jefferson Hour is brought to you by the New Enlightenment Radio Network, a nonprofit organization dedicated to the search for truth and the tradition of Thomas Jefferson. Clay Jenkinson is a Dickinson State University Roosevelt Scholar in Residence with support from the Theodore Roosevelt Medora Foundation. The Jefferson Hour is produced at Makoche Recording Studios in Bismarck, North Dakota. Audio engineer, Lisa Dehonik. Music by Stephen Swinford. Thank you for listening, and please join us again next week for another thought-provoking and historically accurate program through the eyes of Thomas Jefferson.